Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The story of Iraq may be taking a back seat right now to the presidential campaign, plunging stock markets and the economy. But big decisions are being made about the future of the Iraq War and America's commitment. This hour on Point after the surge, how many U.S. troops in Iraq and for how long? Joining me first today from Baghdad is Ned Parker, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Ned, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Ned, we've heard General David Petraeus saying just in the last week that they're looking at alternate futures now to see what troop levels should be in Iraq. He's not ready to make a recommendation yet. Maybe he'll be back in March or April to do that. But what do you see in Iraq right now? What is the current U.S. troop level? And what are the decisions that are being made in the next couple of months here about where it goes?
Well, at present, there are 154,000 U.S. troops in Iraq. Since the surge started a year ago, at its peak, there were 168,000 troops, roughly, in Iraq. Now, the numbers have gone down. The challenge at this point is how do you sustain these gains, this relative peace, particularly in Baghdad, which 12 months ago and even through the summer up to the fall was a very violent, dangerous place. It's still a dangerous place, but there is a calm now. Shops are opening. Neighborhoods that were war zones in western Baghdad where ordinary citizens were afraid of al-Qaeda are now open for business, where people stay out at night on the weekends till 12. So how do you preserve those gains? That's the real question.
Some drawdowns, we're told, are already in the works. What, they'll be taking 5,000 troops or so out per month into the summer? What's the initial target for pulling back off the surge, Nick? Ned?
Well, the surge boiled down to five brigades, combat brigades, coming to Iraq, along with one Marine Expeditionary Unit and two Marine Battalions. A brigade is 3,000 to 4,000 troops. A Marine Expeditionary Unit is 2,200 troops, roughly. One brigade has left, and the Marine Expeditionary Unit has left. Now, there are no more withdrawals scheduled, I believe, until the summer. General Petraeus will be making his prognosis in March in Congress. But the question for him isn't so much how many do you take down and when, as how do you keep this relative calm? How do you maintain this momentum? And the challenges there boil down in many ways is how do you keep these Sunnis, these former Sunni fighters, on the side of the United States and not on the side of al-Qaeda in Iraq? How do you keep them a possible positive player in the Iraqi political process? That's what they have to weigh. The best example I can give you is about a little I believe it was late November, I was out in a part of western Baghdad called Amariya, which until 5-6 months earlier was a no man's land. It was a hell for an Iraqi to live in because al-Qaeda in Iraq, Sunni extremists reigned. It had been overthrown because the U.S. troop presence increased. There was a battalion assigned just to Amariya, so they were able to make an alliance with former Sunni insurgents. That one battalion, when it had started its deployment to Iraq in the fall of 2006, it was assigned almost all of western Baghdad. So how on earth could they have been able to strike deals with local leaders and root out extremists when they had to cover such a span of space? When they had one neighborhood, then they were able to create dramatic change. And that is the lesson that the United States has learned, and one they do not want to squander. So the military is really looking at redistribution of its forces, particularly in Baghdad, so it does not lose the tremendous progress it has made in the last year.
Ned, it was called a surge because troop levels were supposed to go up and then come down. Are you saying that even that return to the pre-surge level is uncertain at this time?
Well, what I'm saying is this. If you speak with the U.S. military command, the troop levels at the time the surge began were between 130 and 134,000 troops. You talk to them now about what a drawdown means, and they say, well, it does not mean you'll get down to that early 130,000 number level. It could still be above that, because the only troops that will be leaving or that will have left are these five brigades, this one Marine Expeditionary Unit, and these two Marine battalions. On top of that, there are what the military calls enablers. That's the military police, which will pair up with the Iraqi security forces in Iraq, and then you have military intelligence, air assets, which are used at Air Force, warplanes, that are used regularly. In the last 10 days, we've seen close to 100,000 pounds of bombs dropped just south of Baghdad in a former insurgent area called Arab Jabor. Those types of assets will not necessarily draw down, is what the military says. So you will see the original surge units removed, but that doesn't mean you will be at the pre-surge level.
Ned, it wasn't long ago that the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, was talking about U.S. troop levels coming down perhaps to 100,000, much further than pre-surge down. We've heard General George Casey, Army Chief of Staff, saying that we're deploying at unsustainable rates now. Do you feel the top officers there in Iraq feeling pressure from the Pentagon, come on, let's draw down?
Well, I think there's a philosophical debate or a tactical debate in the U.S. military now about Iraq. And clearly the engagement in Iraq will go on for some time, most likely, just because of our commitment on the ground. All sides want or rely on the U.S. Presence for different reasons. So you can't forget that the Army Secretary, General Casey, was in Iraq before, and his theory or philosophy on Iraq was you draw down, you have Iraqis in the lead. It was a strategy that was less active, we can say, than the strategy employed in the surge, which is troops in the neighborhood, troops actively involved with Iraqi forces, monitoring them, removing bad elements. I mean, it's been a much more aggressive approach, and that's been because there have been more troops and the American soldiers have been out more in the neighborhoods. So, I mean, I think there's a clear difference in philosophy on how the United States should be involved in Iraq, in the military, between General Petraeus and some of those who have been here before him, who are now in higher positions within the Pentagon.
Now General Casey back in Washington saying, we can't sustain this, it's out of balance. General Petraeus still in the field, not delivering his verdict yet. Ned Parker with the LA Times in Baghdad. Thank you very much for joining us, Ned.
Thank you, Tom.
We're talking about how many U.S. troops should stay in Iraq and for how long. Lots has been said recently. Let's listen just a little bit. Here's an interview last week with ABC News, General David Petraeus saying he was just beginning to study drawing down troops over the long term.
We have begun looking at alternative futures for beyond July to see what could the timing and pace of possible future reductions be. But we're not anywhere near making even a recommendation at this time.
The president, of course, was in the region this month, stood next to General Petraeus at a press conference and said, have whatever you want as long as you want it.
And that will be on track, getting down to 15. And that's what we're on track for. My attitude is, if he didn't want to continue the drawdown, that's fine with me, in order to make sure we succeed. See? I said to the general, if you want to slow her down, fine. It's up to you.
So down to 15 brigades, the president said there, in the Middle East, or maybe not. And then, of course, we had John McCain. What was that bit? Oh, yeah, John McCain at a town hall meeting during the New Hampshire primary campaigning responded to an audience question about how long the U.S. should be in Iraq. McCain's reply got a lot of media attention. We hear the audience member here first.
President Bush has talked about our staying in Iraq for 50 years.
Maybe 100. We've been in South Korea. We've been in Japan for 60 years. We've been in South Korea for 50 years or so. That'd be fine with me, as long as Americans are not being injured or harmed or wounded or killed.
Maybe 100, says John McCain. We're going to hear different views on this today. Joining us first from Washington, D.C., is retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, former Director of the U.S. Marine Corps War College at Quantico, Virginia. Lawrence Wilkerson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
You've said it's not an issue. We can't stay, and yet a lot of people are saying we will, we can, even 100 years, says John McCain.
Well, I think we need to look first. I appreciate what Ned was saying from Baghdad, and I agree with most of what he said. But we've got to appreciate first, before we can talk about what we do next, why we're at where we are now in Baghdad. And it's not largely because of the surge. The surge has helped it. But there are four or five reasons that have put us where we are in Baghdad now. One is that Muqtada al-Sadr and the most powerful Shiite militia in Iraq have gone to ground. His most recent statements about perhaps revisiting that decision are quite disconcerting in that regard. Likewise, many Sunni leaders in key areas have decided to support the coalition tactical objectives and to take arms and to undergo training and so forth because they see the time as being propitious to do that. One wonders what they'll do with these arms and trainings in the future.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are circling back to Iraq this hour, to the surge and the war, and asking how long until how many U.S. troops come home. We've been joined by Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, retired Army Colonel, former head of the Marine Corps War College at Quantico, and professor now of National Security Studies at William & Mary College. Lawrence Wilkerson, you were just ticking off your list, you say, of why the progress that we have seen may not, or is not, entirely due to the surge itself and the troop levels.
Well, that's true, and other reasons are that combat operations, rather robust combat operations by the U.S. military and coalition forces in 2007, more or less took it to the insurgents, largely Sunnis, and they have, as I said, decided to change their ways for whatever purpose, and we'll have to wait and see what those purposes are. There's also the general war weariness of the Iraqi population, and lastly, most of the ethnic cleansing that was going on has been completed, and the boroughs, if you will, in Baghdad in particular, but around Iraq, are pretty much ethnically separated now, or religiously separated. So this is kind of a weird equilibrium that Ryan Crocker, our ambassador, and General Petraeus, our military head, have come to in Iraq, and they're trying to deepen and expand it. But in no way does it provide us with any evidence of sustainability, and more importantly, it has not really curbed the violence to the extent that we want it curbed, and the last few days, of course, have demonstrated that with quite a few deaths, mostly Iraqi, in the country. So this situation does not lead one to believe that we can predict what a post-surge Iraq would look like. But to return to your earlier point, yes, and Ned's point, we're destroying our ground forces. General Casey, it's somewhat a matter of chagrin for me because he wasn't saying this when he was in command of the troops in Iraq, but he clearly knew it. Now that he's head of the Army, Chief of Staff of the Army, he is now saying it. We're 15,000 captains short in our Army. We're destroying the educational network and fabric of the institutional Army back here in the United States. We've got a $50 to $100 billion bill just to bring the Army and the Marine Corps back up to its equipment and readiness status pre-invasion. But this just cannot go on except under one condition with regard to that fact, and that is that we will have an Army and a Marine Corps that are pretty much broken.
So what should the number be? We've heard, you know, President Bush essentially saying, leave it wherever you need it, General Petraeus. We heard the expectation was there it would come back down at least down to 130,000. We heard Robert Gates briefly talking about 100,000. Are you suggesting that or something lower, and when?
I'm saying we've got to get out. We've got to do it carefully, and we've got to do it slowly, but we've got to get out. And as far as President Bush comments go, this administration made a fundamental strategic decision 6 to 7 months ago, and that was to pass Iraq with David Petraeus as the shield under which they pass it to the next administration. this administration hadn't got a clue what to do in Iraq. And Bush's statements, more or less, if you read between the lines, indicate that General Petraeus can do anything he wants to, because General Petraeus is Bush's shield till he gets out of the White House.
Lawrence Wilkerson, please stand by. Joining us now from Washington is Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution. He's been a big supporter of the surge strategy in Iraq and an influential voice in charting the current path. His big op-ed pieces last summer and again over the weekend in the Washington Post have helped set the terms of the debate and advocated keeping troops in Iraq in substantial numbers. Michael O'Hanlon, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
You hear Lawrence Wilkerson's interpretation of what has happened and not happened because of the surge and his admonition that we're breaking the military and we need to carefully but deliberately get U.S. troops out of there. What do you say?
Well, first, it's an honor to be on with Colonel Wilkerson. I've admired him greatly, admired you greatly, sir, over the years, and I appreciate the opportunity. I certainly assess the situation in somewhat similar terms, that there have been a number of factors in Iraq that have contributed to the improvement. I would want to say emphatically, though, a point that he hedged on a little, which is that the improvement is dramatic, absolutely dramatic. And there is no longer a serious debate about that, in my judgment. He probably wasn't suggesting that there really is, but it's still far too violent of a place. But I just want to be emphatic on that point. The progress is remarkable, but it certainly is not yet something we can say is durable. We don't know. And I agree with Colonel Wilkerson and before with Ned Parker about some of the tensions that are underlying. What will happen, for example, to the Sunni tribes if and when we decide to draw down, which obviously at some point we will and must. And so I very much share the concerns. That's one of the reasons, however, why I wind up saying we've got to do this quite gradually, because the progress in Iraq is tenuous, it's fragile. We already have a fairly rapid drawdown plan for this year. Taking 25% of the combat force structure out in the space of 8 months is a very, very rapid drawdown. And I think we're going to have to just pause and see how that looks. I know it's easy for a civilian sitting in a comfortable office in Washington to say this. My heart goes out to the military families and the troops who are doing so much. We've been asking far too much of them. But my assessment is that most of them, now that they see progress, would much rather not give up this effort and have so much of the sacrifice that they and their colleagues have made already potentially be squandered. That's never a good argument for reinforcing failure. If you're on a bad trajectory, saying that you've already lost a lot of people and spent a lot of money is not a good reason to stay. But if you've seen a dramatic improvement in the situation, then I think it does validate the sacrifice of so many to try to find a way to at least salvage a passable outcome. Not victory, not some great success, but a salvageable stability. A
couple of questions then right off that. First of all, that 25% drawdown that you're expecting, what number would that bring us to in your calculus? And what if Colonel Wilkerson is correct that a lot of this progress that's been seen is not because of the surge, and meanwhile, with all these troops in Iraq, we are breaking the U.S. Army everywhere?
Well, first of all, I very much hope it's true, and I agree with his assessment, as I said, that there are other factors, and I hope that means that we will be able to draw down and keep drawing down. But
you're not proposing that. I mean, you're saying, well, 25%, but not more.
No, but look at the terms of the debate. Some people, including at one time Secretary Gates, have said we might cut from 20 brigades to 10 brigades in the space of 12 months. That is a radical cut. Nation building is a slow enterprise, and we've only been doing a good job at it in Iraq for about a year. The first 3 to 4 years were largely squandered, and I am a big critic of the Bush administration for how that 3 to 4 year period was handled.
Ten brigades will bring us down to what, Michael O'Hanlon?
In numbers, going
roughly.
From 20 to 10 brigades would, in terms of overall troop numbers, not be a 50% cut in manpower. It would probably, I haven't seen the calculation, but it would probably take us down to about 100,000 people in broad terms, maybe 90,000 in that general vicinity, because, of course, some of the support infrastructure does not get cut proportionately with the combat force structure. But I think 10 brigades is something that we should be envisioning. Let's hope for the end of 2009, but not for the end of 2008.
Colonel Wilkerson, that was Robert Gates' hope for maybe even later this year. Now it certainly seems like it's receding as a goal. What would your goal be and when?
Well, Michael's right, I think. We've got to do this slowly. We've got to do it carefully. And there is a tipping point in there for what I call the institutional army, the fabric of my army. And that tipping point is somewhere probably around 90,000, maybe as high as 100,000. And what I mean by that is in terms of deployment, you can keep them deployed for as long as you want to keep them deployed and not have a major impact on the institutional fabric of the Army, or for that matter, the Marine Corps, though the Marine Corps, being expeditionary by nature, is a little bit better attuned to these sorts of things. At the same time, though, you've got to consider what Michael was talking about, and that is the sacrifice that families are making, that multiple tours. My son just came home from Kirkuk, and he walked through BWI Airport, met me. He's on the major's list. He said, "I'm out, Dad." He submitted his letter now, and he's getting out.
Out of the military, leaving.
His wife brought pressure to bear on him. And I've seen this before. I saw this for multiple years in Vietnam. So there are other aspects of this, too. But I agree with Michael that if we do it slowly, we do it carefully, we get down to that tipping point figure fairly swiftly, say in the next 18 months or so, that we can save the land forces in terms of the bill we're going to have to pay for them. It's still going to be quite a high bill. And we can also protect our interest in Iraq. But I do believe, for other reasons, and this is important, for very strategic reasons, we do not need to be tied down on Arab soil with so many of our forces.
Let me just understand. You said 18 months down to what number? I can't quite keep up with your
military shorthand. I said we need to get past that tipping point, whatever it is. And I leave it to General Casey and others to figure out what that is. And that point is where we're not doing incredible damage to the institutional fabric of the Army, given the numbers we have in the Army, which are quite low. At the same time, we're keeping a considerable number of troops deployed, and it's probably somewhere between 90 and 100,000.
Lawrence Wilkerson, Michael O'Hanlon, speaking of military families, we have many on the line. Let's go to one. St. Paul, Minnesota. Adam, you're on the air.
How are you guys doing?
All right. What do you know, Adam?
You know, my father, he's a Blackhawk A Company 2147 out of St. Paul, Minnesota here, and he was recently home on leave, and he first arrived just stationed in Balad, just north of Baghdad. He routinely flies around Baghdad, and since he first got there 6 months ago, he's seen less and less nightly activity. He, according to his reports, the insurgency has helped. They discovered a lot of weapons caches. He's just seen a lot less activity on the ground in terms of what the insurgents have been doing.
So what does that leave you thinking, or him thinking, Adam, about U.S. troop levels there? Should we be drawing down or hanging in?
I think we should be hanging in, absolutely. He's seen a lot of good progress. Again, I've never been there, but this is coming directly from my father. He's seen a lot of good progress, and he thinks that should definitely hang in there, and I would agree with him as well. So,
Lawrence Wilkerson, there's Adam. His dad, just home on leave, says we got to hang in. What do you say to you know, it's his father serving?
Well, my son saw the same thing, flying with the Iraqi 3rd Air Force about 1,000 feet above the ground in daylight over Baghdad, Kirkuk, Mosul, a host of other places, Diyala province, Al Anbar province. But the question again is, are the Sunnis, who are largely behind this insurgency, are they biding their time, being armed, trained, moneyed, and so forth by the Saudis and others, until we are down to a level or gone, and they can reengage in what will be then a very bloody civil war? That's the ultimate long-term question, I think, with regard to the interior situation in Iraq. I don't disagree that we should take advantage of this weird equilibrium, as I've described it, and we should try to do the best we can to leave a stable, a reasonably stable Iraq as we draw down. But I do realize there are time limits to this, not the least of which is imposed by the fact that the new president in January is going to be confronted, in my view, with an absolutely horrible economic situation. Indeed, it may be a global economic downturn.
Sure feels like it could be today.
Absolutely, and we're just ignoring this with respect to far-flung military engagement and what I consider to be overextension of our military. And the new president's going to have few choices about whether or not to continue billions of dollars of outpouring to Iraq.
Let's take a call from no less than Waterloo, Iowa. Kirsten, you're on the air.
Yes, I just have a point about, or a question about taxes. As a discussion group with my friends, you know, we talk about the Iraq war. We've thrown around the idea of making a wartime tax so that Congress and our government might be held a little bit more accountable for the decisions that we're making there. And I'd like to know what you guys think about that, if it could work, why or why not that would be.
Michael O'Hanlon, there's a lot of talk about a stimulus package right now in Congress, the opposite of new taxes to help pay for the war. And yet, Lawrence Wilkerson's been enumerating for us the unaddressed mounting cost of the war, never mind the sort of real cash out of pocket right now. You know, Kirsten's saying, let's pay more for it now so we know what it costs.
Well, I think Kirsten's point is a very solid one in broad terms, philosophically and otherwise, but it can't be done now for the reasons, Tom, that you just mentioned. I think any economist would say what we need now is a stimulus package, and or at least the ones I'm hearing are saying that louder and louder as the days go by. So I think it's a very reasonable point when you look back at the last 5 to 7 years of our political discourse and the options we had in much of that period. I don't think it's an option today.
$2 or $3 billion a week for the Iraq war. Is there a point, looking at the economy around us, Lawrence Wilkerson points to it, is there a point at which this is simply economically unsustainable, whatever the facts on the ground there?
Well, I think the answer... Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I agree with Michael. For Bush to say, let's go to war against these terrorists and everybody else keep shopping while less than 1% of America bleeds and dies on the battlefields is unconscionable for me. This was handled terribly by the administration, and I agree with your caller that there ought to be some sacrifice by the rest of the people. At the same time, I agree with Michael that now is probably not the physical time to be able to do it. And I'm $145 billion stimulus, that's like dropping a penny in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Mm. We are awash right now in this country in $45 trillion of corporate and private debt. No one knows the dimensions that psychological fear associated with this might take this economy. We could be looking at a repeat of the late 20s and early 30s in far more far-flung and deeper and more sophisticated ways than then, because we've done so much to financialize our country over the last 20 or 30 years. So I just don't see any president confronted with the economic challenges that he or she is going to be confronted with wanting or being desirous of continuing this outflow of cash for much longer.
And yet, there it is right now. Lawrence Wilkerson, Michael O'Hanlon, let me go back to Iraq for just a moment. We're joined from Diwaniya, south of Baghdad, by Marine Captain Seth Moulton. He's on his fourth tour in Iraq. He's now working as a special assistant to General David Petraeus, the commander of coalition forces in Iraq. 29 years old. Captain Moulton, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We're going to ask you about troop levels, but let me just get a sense of how you see your country looking at what you all are up to out there right now. I mean, I'm sure you get the news. The whole planet today is thinking about economies and stock markets, and things look really rocky out there. Does it sometimes feel like a forgotten war with the campaign, presidential campaign going on at home and everybody obsessing on subprime mortgages and falling Wall Street and all the rest? Do you sometimes wonder if people are still paying attention?
Absolutely. I actually was fortunate enough to spend a couple weeks back home in December, and it was amazing to me. When I first got home, the first thing I did is go to the CNN homepage, and I couldn't find a single link on the entire homepage to anything in Iraq that day. So it does feel like a forgotten war. I think Colonel Wilkerson is right that it's always been a war that very, very few people have any personal stake in, because so few, a small percentage of America is actually fighting it. But especially now, when the word back home is that things are going very well, I think people are just taking it off the radar screen.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Iraq, circling back to Iraq, to the surge and the war, and asking how long until how many U.S. troops come home. Kind of reality check on all the talk of victory and the talk of withdrawal, easy withdrawal maybe, today. We've been joined by Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institution and retired Army Colonel, longtime Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, Lawrence Wilkerson. He is the former director of the U.S. Marine Corps War College at Quantico, Virginia. In a Senate hearing already last November, General George Casey, the Army's top commander, said the armed forces needed to get bigger overall. But he said if there were another conflict, he probably, somewhere else in the world, he wouldn't have the troops to carry out the mission.
As we look to the future, we do so with an army that's already stretched by the impacts of 6 years at war. And while we remain a resilient, committed, professional force, today's army is out of balance.
Speaking in Atlanta, Georgia, yesterday, Senator Barack Obama criticized the Iraq war.
When young Americans serve tour after tour after tour after tour of duty in a war that should have never been authorized and should have never been waged, we have an empathy deficit.
How long until how many U.S. troops come home? We have one of those young troopers who has spent tour after tour in Iraq. With us from Diwaniya, Iraq, Marine Captain Seth Moulton is here. 29 years old, has a degree in physics from Harvard. Now he is a special assistant to General David Petraeus, commander of coalition forces in Iraq. He was saying just before the break that sometimes it does indeed feel like a forgotten war out there. Seth Moulton, let us ask you about troop levels. Your general's not saying yet how much he wants for how long, so I don't expect you're going to give us a number here. But how do you hear the debate, the conversation in Iraq among U.S. military officers there? Do they feel like we have to stay, you know, high volume for a long time? Should we be getting out? Should we be down to that 100,000 or below that Secretary Gates earlier talked about? Lawrence Wilkerson says maybe we should be aiming for.
Well, there's no question that the progress here has really been significant, just like Michael Hanlon said. And, I mean, the commanders here on the ground and their soldiers and Marines are responsible for that, and they don't want to see it go away. I think that perhaps America underestimates just how much security has really improved here, but they may overestimate the degree to which that is durable. And a lot of it right now is tenuous, and it's held together by American troop presence. So just withdraw the troops before Iraqis step up, both security-wise and also politically, to fill the gap and to take the place of the Americans and their troops and the agreements with tribes and whatnot that have enabled this security. To do that too soon is very risky.
But if it's not durable now, after the better part of a year with the surge and nearly 5 years of this war, how long should America be expecting that their troops have to stay there to make it durable? And can it ever be made durable?
Well, the problem is, as General Petraeus said when he back when he was first appointed, this ultimately is a political problem here. And there has been tremendous military progress over the past year. That is without question. But I think the political progress has been, quite frankly, very disappointing. And so there needs to be Iraqi political process to make any of these American security gains worthwhile, to make them last, because otherwise it will all be for nothing. And I'll give you just a simple example. There's a lot of talk about how important these tribal security agreements have been, especially with the Sunnis out in a place like Anbar province.
Yeah.
Well, we have agreements with Sunni tribes to provide security. We need to transition those to the Iraqi government because we want to withdraw troops from Anbar. So if we don't have American troops there to supervise these security arrangements, they need to be transitioned to the Iraqi government. And right now the Iraqi government is balking hard at taking up any of those contracts.
Lawrence,
so that's a simple example of why there needs to be political progress on the Iraqi side to make any of this last.
It's a simple and stark example, and from the field. Captain Moulton, please stand by. Lawrence Wilkerson in Washington. Here's one among many young guys, you know, at work in Iraq for the U.S. military. He says, without political progress, it's all for nothing. Do you see signs that we might get that progress?
Let me say, first of all, that Seth Moulton is one of my heroes, and so are all the members of his team that are working in Iraq right now. I share his concern about political progress, and with the current leadership in Iraq, the current constitutional structure, if you will, the current parliament, I don't see that political progress coming within what I see as a time frame for us to have to make significant troop withdrawals. That's the problem. Whether we make those withdrawals despite that political reconciliation or success not being apparent is a big question, and I think we're going to be compelled to.
And what do you say to this young soldier's call saying, you know, don't let us slip back? We've worked hard for this progress. We don't want to lose it.
I left Vietnam in 1970, and less than half a decade later watched helicopters being pushed off U.S. aircraft carriers at sea. You don't want to ask me that question.
Let's go to Jim in Salem, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
It's more of a statement, I guess. This whole thing about, you know, our progress in Iraq, you know, it's a very long story. We've been hearing this for a long time, and we're, you know, maybe we have been making gains, but, I mean, I served in the National Guard. Thankfully, I didn't get stop lost. I know a lot of guys who did, and their lives were frankly screwed up because of it. You know, and it's just thinking more close to home. I mean, we're losing our liberties every day. You know, laws are being passed that go so against the Constitution, and it just everything's all upside down, turned around. I just really wish we'd get out of there. I'm a big Ron Paul supporter. You know, I like his philosophy, just get out. I think Iraq and the Iraqis are intelligent enough to take care of themselves. And
Jim, we've got the perspective, and we appreciate it. Let's get one more right here. Andy in Black River, New York, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I'm a major here at the Fort Drum, a KW pilot, done my tours in Iraq. Got wounded in Purple Heart, and I think the point I want to make is, you know, we can't just pull out all of a sudden of what the colonel's been saying and Mike's been saying and everybody's been saying. It's got to be phased. There is a campaign plan, whether we know it or not, whether the civilian side knows it or not. I mean, there is a strategy, and I think to pull out quickly is not the right answer. From my point of view, it would be letting down comrades of mine that I've lost, family members that have lost friends and family over there. It's got to be phased. I do think at some point we will have to leave, but on the flip side, I think that eventually once we're out of there, whether we have an advisory role or whatever's left, the Sunnis and the Shias and all the different groups over there, you know, they've been at war, well, not at war, but they've been fighting for hundreds of years. And it's maybe to be pessimistic to say that they're going to revert back to fighting and who's going to dominate. But I think that we are making progress. It would be in vain just to leave, or a shame just to leave and pull out. But that's pretty much my comment.
Andy, first of all, thank you for your service. But let me ask you, because we can all hear a kind of contradiction in, right there in your view. On the one hand, don't leave because sacrifices have been made and you have to honor those. On the other hand, you're saying these people have been fighting for hundreds of years, and it sounds like you're saying they're going to fight again.
Well, my personal feeling is that there will never be a true peace, at least in the Iraqi region. I mean, there are sects and there are groups between Sunnis and Shias when I was there that were getting along, and whether or not it was just because we were there, present, maintaining a peace and maintaining some stability, I don't know. I would say yes, but I have also seen areas when I was there where we had gone in, secured an area, Shias and Sunnis were getting along, and as soon as we pulled out, it started again with insurgent groups moving back in and creating fear amongst each other. You know, who's in charge. And I think once we have end up pulling out, hopefully that won't happen. It'd be nice to have stability in the entire region, especially in Iraq. But my personal feeling is that I think that it will just revert back to the way it was. Some new regime will come up, and that's what will happen.
Andy, Major, thank you very much for your call from Fort Drum. Captain Moulton in Diwania, do you share that fear in the deep of night, in your dark hours, that yes, you want to hold the progress, yes, you've seen it and it's dramatic, what's your confidence level that it can be brought to some, you know, new status of stability that will make it clearly worth the effort in the end?
Well, I see the degree to which individual Iraqis on the ground here have been willing to reconcile after three or four just absolutely brutal years of war and sectarian violence. I mean, the degree to which Sunnis and Shia are coming together today is pretty remarkable, and I think that does bode well for the future. I don't share the view that they are just forever destined to be warring over here in the Middle East, and quite frankly, if that is your view, then you should say we should just leave today because it's not worth a single more American life wasted for no result. But at the same time, I have to come back to the issue of Iraqi political progress. And, you know, if there is not political progress to make these security gains durable, then we're in a real quandary. And, you know, there hasn't been much to show for Iraqi political progress in the past year.
Michael O'Hanlon in Washington, that was supposed to be the primary goal of the surge, to make a space for political progress. Everybody agrees it pretty much hasn't happened. Little things, but there's Captain Moulton staring at it. He doesn't see much. And without political progress, he says it's all for nothing. What gives you confidence that may still emerge, or are you assuming that it won't?
Well, first, I'm honored also to be on with Seth Moulton, and I had a very good experience with him this past summer when he helped show me around Iraq. And greetings to you, Seth, and hats off to you for all the great work over
Thanks
there.
Very much.
And I have to, you know, take what he says very seriously. And I think, obviously, Iraqi politics is a glass that's much more empty than full. But I think that there has been a little more progress than people commonly acknowledge in the American debate. This is not meant as some rah-rah speech in defense of either the Iraqi political system or the Bush administration. But, for example, something General Petraeus often talks about, the passage of the pension law last fall, which allows, now that you have this reformed debathification law, despite all of its imperfections and that it still has to go through a final approval by the Presidency Council, but if you combine those two, what it means is a lot of former Baathists will at least be able to get their pensions, even if they don't get their jobs back. That's something. Something else that's happening, we have no passage of this so-called hydrocarbon law to set the terms for how Iraq will exploit its oil resources in the future and
share the wealth from
yeah. But we do have a deal whereby right now Baghdad is actually sending quite a bit more money out to the provinces each and every year than it was before. So it's sort of a de facto temporary form of a hydrocarbon arrangement. So there are a number of things that are happening at the local level, and again, Seth would know much more than I, so I am discouraged to hear his generally worried assessment, although he did also say he's seen some reconciliation too. But I think that the glass is about a quarter full is the way I would sum it up.
Is that enough? Is that enough to leave the higher level of troops? Is that enough to hang in?
Not yet.
Let's go to Carl in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Carl, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The reason I wanted to call is my son just came back from his second extended tour with the 1st Cavalry Division. He's a company commander, and we talked about impacts on families. He's been in Baghdad 29 months on two tours, and his daughter's been on this earth for 50 months, over half of her life, and that doesn't even count time out in the desert in California and all the other training. And him and a lot of other captains that I've spoken with when I've been out to Fort Hood, they're all looking to go and teach and get in a non-deployed status. And my son, fortunately, is going to go teach at ROTC. He considers it, you know, a career dead ender, but at least he'll be non-deployed. He can try to make 20 years, get his pension, and raise his children, which is his goal at this point in time after 29 months in Baghdad.
29 months is a lot, and we thank him for that service, but that leaves a big imprint on any family, Carl.
And the kids, you know, I got to see his daughter learn how to walk and talk, not him. And, you know, a lot of guys from discussions I've had, they want to be able to raise their children, and they don't see a draft. They don't see America lining up to join the Army in huge numbers. And, you know, it's just very few people are bearing this burden.
Real progress, but glass, what, a quarter full on the political front maybe, and real costs at the same time. Lawrence Wilkerson, let me ask you about the quality of the debate over the war on the campaign trail. We have heard a fair amount of talk from Republican candidates about victory, on to victory. We hear a fair amount from Democrats about withdrawal. Is the debate up to the challenge of the Iraq war reality?
Not at all, in my view, and that's the reason I don't have anyone I'm going to vote for yet. I hope that changes before November. Let me throw out some geostrategic matters here that'll just dull your eyes and most of your listeners, but they're very important. One is Iran. We have to establish some kind of relationship with Tehran. The other is the Arab-Israeli situation. Bush started something at Annapolis in November. He'd best be willing to put his entire strength behind finishing it, or at least bringing it to a point where it can be finished by the next president. If we don't have a final settlement in that issue, including Jerusalem, right of return, borders, settlements, and so forth, or we don't make a major progress towards that final settlement, then all bets are off about a post-surge Iraq. Those two issues, Iran and the Arab-Israeli situation, have as much impact on whatever futures out there for our situation with Iraq as anything else. And I don't see any candidate even talking about it.
Captain Moulton, we heard the Iraqi defense minister say, oh, we may need U.S. troops until 2012 inside and 2018 on our borders. John McCain said 100 years if necessary. How long? How long might this need to go on? How long could it go on?
Well, Tom, I mean, the problem is there's really no telling until you see that progress on the ground, and that's when you can make the decisions to pull back troops. I mean, let me just say that I would not have come back here for my fourth tour if I thought that this was a lost cause. But at the same time, I think there's a little bit of an irony in our situation right now in that at a time when we need probably more American pressure, and a lot of Iraqis say this, on the Iraqi political system to make political progress, I think we're finding it almost hard to apply that pressure because ostensibly things are going so well and security has improved so much. So, you know, maybe it's a difficult time to make very hard political decisions because, you know, according to everyone back home, things are going very well. And so it is a difficult position right now to be able to make any of those judgments about withdrawal without, you know, seeing durable progress.
We have got to have a higher level of American engagement with this war, clearly, to get the right kind of public awareness and pressure and support for people just like you. Marine Captain Seth Moulton in Diwania, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome, Tom.
Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., always good to have you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Colonel Wilkerson, always wonderful to have you. Thank you very much for your thoughts today.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks for allowing me to listen to Seth.
Good to have you all. Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.